Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther, and today we've got, in a long line of great guests, we've got another one, of course, that's what we do, and I'm talking about Gi-Boom Kim, who is a researcher at the Korean Institute for Defense Analysis, which is sort of South Korea's big strategic think tank. And they do a lot of great work. They've got a lot of great folks there. So go if you're interested in, you know, Korean strategic issues, go to Kita's website, read some of Gi-Boom's work, read, there's a lot of other great folks doing some good work. So go there, and Gi-Boom, welcome to NucleCast. It's your first time to be here, so welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Adam. Thank you for having me in your great NucleCast. It's my honor to be one of your guests here in your podcast. Excited to be talking with you about issues related to South Korea.
So South Korea had an election about a month or so ago. You and I were at a war game, and the election took place during that. You know, that was an interesting time. And things have changed because, you know, like the United States, South Korea, you know, presidents matter. And the party in power, you know, it changes, you know, policy quite dramatically, which is sort of a standard feature of the United States. And it's similar in South Korea. So now that you have a new president and President Lee, can you tell us about the Democratic Party of Korea? How is it different? You know, President Yoon was, you know, he was a conservative. Now you have a progressive. What is the difference? How does that difference impact how they relate to, say, North Korea and China? And does that make any difference for, you know, the U.S. alliance and maybe nuclear weapons policies or aspirations? That's like five questions all wrapped in one. But, I'm confident it's one you know the answer to. So can you sort of kick us off and just sort of give us the layout?
Of course, Adam. Great questions. Of course, all the South Korea watchers, peninsula watchers, would be curious about what changes will happen after the election. Now, as you said, it's a month after the election. And we've already seen certain changes in our politics or government. The president's starting to name his ministers. They were having confirmation hearings at the National Assembly. Some ministers, including the foreign minister, was recently given out his role. Now he's officially started his role. I think the news in the media, they said he's about to visit the U.S. this week for negotiations with regards to tariffs, trade deals, and stuff. So your first question about President Lee being the president from the Democratic Party, one of the progressives. Will there be dramatic changes? To be honest, there will be more continuity than changes when you're talking about foreign policy and security, national defense issues. Although there will be changes in the priorities, I would say, and definitely some changes to inter-Korean relationships. When you talk about priorities, I'm saying this from the viewpoint that if you're a conservative government, a conservative party, a president from the conservative party, when it comes to inter-Korean relations, you tend to focus more on North Korea being the first to give up nuclear weapons, the first to give up on provocations, the first to offer a good hand towards South Korea. And then you start talking, doing dialogues, and then you start to maybe perhaps think about lifting some sanctions in exchange together in close consultation with the United States and other our allies and partners. But now if you're talking about the Democratic Party and the wider progressive movement, inter-Korean relations starts with South Korea taking the initiative and being the party to start offering a more friendlier hand towards North Korea. For example, the government would sort of, now they're talking about reinstating the 919 military agreement, which is focused on reducing tensions on the border areas. So that's the reason why the government is now trying to ban South Korean NGOs from sending these balloons towards North Korea with all these sort of flyers with inside the balloons. You would also think about trying to pull the North Koreans back to the negotiating table. And that's where the changes influence other foreign relations, for instance, with China and with Russia. So this just naturally goes to your question about what changes will be there in terms of China. Now, China obviously has a certain level, a degree of influence on North Korea, and that's what we all think they have, the influence they have, what we expect them to have. The progressives have a more higher level of expectation. So you can see that in the former Moon Jae-in government, the government before Yoon Suk-yeol, that they tried to say to China that, you know, China needs to sort of persuade North Korea to be more forthcoming in sort of these dialogues for denuclearization, for more peaceful Korean Peninsula, to, you know, scale back provocations, missile tests, all those kind of stuff. So now that Lee Jae-myung's government is now, they've taken power, the progressives are in charge, they would likely try to restore South Korea-China relations in order to influence North Korea so that they can come back to the negotiation table and to sort of help create better conditions for a more favorable inter-Korean relations and hopefully for future denuclearization negotiations. Now, that also is the same for Russia, although that's a very different story now that we still have the war ongoing in Ukraine. The Russian invasion is still not over. So that's a very difficult side of the story. But the logic behind the progressives or certain experts arguing for managing South Korea and Russia relations is that at some point Russia has to be involved so that we can sort of persuade or push or pressure North Korea to come back to denuclearization negotiations. So I've been repeating this denuclearization a lot during my first comment. So that's actually the foundation, so to speak, of the progressives' sort of initiative about, or vision, so to speak, about a peace on the Korean Peninsula. It starts with denuclearization or non-nuclear Korean Peninsula.
I'll just stop there for a moment. Let me ask you, so, you know, in American politics, you tend to have sort of on the nuclear issue, you tend to have the disarmament community is, you know, pretty idealistic, right? They see that, you know, the world is what we can make it, you know, we can rid the world of conflict and, you know, with the right values and the right institutions and all of that, we can sort of build this idealistic world that nobody has nuclear weapons, et cetera. We would call it, you know, a philosophy of idealism. And then we have sort of the realists who say, hey, listen, people are fundamentally bad and wicked, and nuclear weapons are but one of the many constraints. They constrain nations as opposed to, you know, firearms constrain individuals because, you know, the threat is such that, you know, it's a threat that you don't want to bear. You know, getting shot, for example, or getting, you know, attacked with nuclear weapons. And because people are fundamentally wicked and evil, therefore, you know, these weapons are, you know, good and required because they constrain behavior. And we're never going to get, we're never going to change the fundamental, you know, nature of people. So therefore, you know, sort of idealism will never work. And so you have these two kind of competing philosophies or schools of thought. And is that sort of dichotomy applicable in the Korean context, in that is the Democratic Party sort of idealistic in its view of the fact that, you know, North Korea will one day, you know, denuclearize and will come to the table, and that unification in a peaceful way is possible? And then would the sort of the conservatives be, you know, hey, listen, this is an authoritarian regime. Authoritarians don't give up nuclear weapons because it's the thing that guarantees they stay in power. Is that sort of applicable in the Korean context, or is it just, hey, listen, that's not how things work here? Can you maybe help us better understand how the two, you know, main political parties sort of philosophically see their relationship and, you know, this desire to denuclearize?
That's a very good question, Adam. I would say to some degree that is applicable in the Korean Peninsula context, but I wouldn't say it's as exactly as it works out in the United States. And because non-proliferation is not, you don't have progressives and conservatives divided on non-proliferation issues. They do have a general sense of agreement that if it is possible, it is better to follow non-proliferation, the vision of non-proliferation, policies regarding non-proliferation, because if possible, if non-proliferation is actually achievable, you would have a safer security environment. No one actually challenges that kind of assumption. But as you said, there's this realist sense of the world where you explain that for self-defense purposes, because you cannot actually fully trust the other, and there's no sole authority, global authority, that can sort of control your adversary from taking hostile action against you. At some point, you need those armed forces, your military capabilities, including nuclear weapons, perhaps if you have them, and that's why there are nuclear weapons, and that's the reason why the P5 decided to have nuclear weapons, and sort of those kind of logics do sort of make sense to some. But again, coming back to your original question about whether it's applicable, I would say the progressive, a lot more than the conservatives, think that if the U.S., and South Korea and all other neighboring countries could sort of provide North Korea with a more safer environment, if North Korea feels safe, if the Kim Jong-un regime feels that there's no danger of a regime change or sort of threat to its regime survival, the country's survival, then one day, as you said, they might be able to be persuaded to give up their nuclear weapons, be a normal country, and sort of be included within the international society as a normal state. And the conservatives, more than the progressives, think, as you said, that because they're authoritarian states, they're authoritarian regime, and because they have that history in the 1950s when they sort of launched attack on South Korea, started the Korean War, that you cannot fully trust them. And in recent years, within sort of 1-2 decades, we had the Yeonpyeong Island shelling. We had the Cheonan ship sinking and other sort of provocations that we cannot fully trust them. Even if we provide them with a safer environment, they will not give up their nuclear weapons. So there are those competing camps of thought. So you can say these part of the Progressive Party that they are ideal about North Korean intentions, their thoughts about nuclear weapons, conservatives more realist. But it doesn't mean that both parties fundamentally differ, that they're different, fundamentally different about non-proliferation. So it's sort of complicated, a bit different, but as you said, there are those idealists, realists on both sides. But just to put it simple, more on the progressive party think that since we're the better states, we're stronger, we're more prosperous, that we have that opportunity to, you know, give North Korea a hand so that they can take the chance to denuclearize. But again, the Conservative Party is not that into that kind of perspective.
Yeah. Well, okay. So it's that time in the show where we have to take a quick break. So we'll do that. And when we come back, I've got a question for you. So we haven't quite yet talked about how the new administration may or may not change sort of the U.S. South Korea agreement. So let's talk about that when we come back, and you're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrent Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, and we're talking to Gi-Bum Kim from KIDA, the Korean Institute for Defense Analysis. And I posed a question right before the break. So tell us about, you know, the future of the U.S.-South Korean alliance.
There's been some commentaries about changes in ROK-US alliance policy relations, some even media reports about possible changes in our relationship. But to be honest, there's been more continuity on alliance politics policy in South Korea because even progressives that talk about a more having more strategic autonomy. They also stress the importance of the ROK-US alliance as the bedrock of South Korean security policy and strategy. So whether there's going to be a huge dramatic shift after the progressives taking power, the answer would be simply no. But the change would be about that part where you want more autonomy. The word autonomy is quite tricky, and it sounds different in English and in Korean when you translate between them. But the progressive, so this, the reason why I'm saying this is very tricky is because when you talk about military capabilities, having more stronger military platforms, cutting edge, more strong, like more longer range missiles, more high tech weaponry, more fancy satellites, there's no divide in both sides. You want better equipment, you want better forces, you want better readiness, more stronger posture, so that you're a capable state as well as a very capable partner to the United States and other regional states partners. But that autonomy part bears a very different meaning when it comes to, for example, OPCON transition. So that's the main, one of the main issues, because that OPCON transition is linked to the sense of sovereignty, a sense of nationalism, because in the current structure, during peacetime, South Korea has its OPCON. But when it switches to wartime through CFC, Combined Forces Command, and the structure that surrounding it, the United States, the U.S. forces, the U.S. commander has the OPCON. Now, does that mean the U.S. commander will fully control South Korean forces how he likes to control it? No, it doesn't mean that. It means that the commander will take orders from both the Korean president and the U.S. president. The two presidents will agree on certain things, and then the orders will be issued. And then with OPCON, the commanders will do operations, missions, etc. But this makes sense when you talk to experts like you or me or other, you know, including other friends, colleagues. But if you talk to the general public about OPCON, they don't really understand how it works. So OPCON transition, when you say you don't have wartime OPCON, that means, the 1945 liberation after the Second World War, the restoration after the Korean War, all of those things are not complete. So in order to be a complete national sovereign state, you need wartime OPCON. So that's the autonomy part.
This has been a big issue. I was doing some reading here recently on this issue, and you know, we've made the U.S. has made the promise that we will return operational control to the ROK Army during time of war, but then, you know, through various reasons, it's been delayed. And, you know, there's the question, you know, just like in Europe, the U.S. tends to take, you know, the leadership role in NATO and leads NATO. And then the question is, will the U.S. allow its, you know, forces to operate under the control, you know, of a ROK commander during a time of conflict? And we don't quite know the answer to that because it hasn't really happened yet. And so, it's both sensitive for, you know, South Koreans who are like, hey, you know, we want to, you know, it's going to be a fight and it's going to be Seoul that's getting shelled and by the, by the North or the Chinese or whomever. And, you know, we want to be able to, you know, wage war. And it's also sort of a big brother, little brother question of, you know, are we equals or not? And so it's an understandable desire for the ROK to want to have that operational control. And I imagine it's going to work itself out. And, you know, because we've had quite a, you know, 70 years of collaboration and working together. So it'll probably work itself out, but it's certainly understood. I don't know how many Americans paid that much attention to this issue and understand the sensitivities, particularly in the Korean public. But I certainly understand, you know, that's one of those little areas that there's just that, you know, it's just it's like in an oyster, you know, it's that grain of sand that's the irritant.
Exactly. That's part of the sentiment that South Koreans have. You know, in general, if you ask the polls, a huge majority would always support OPCON transition. And as you said, this is not only a recent issue. It's been ongoing for quite a long time. And both governments, we've had agreements about conditions-based OPCON transition plan. And we've had, we've been testing whether South Korea actually are getting better, are getting ready to have OPCON back. And I've heard that we've made certain progress on those lines to meet those conditions. But the trickiest condition is whether the security environment surrounding the Korean Peninsula actually supports OPCON transition. Now, that is actually one of the conditions. Besides all the operational sort of capabilities and your actual, whether you actually have certain mission capabilities with your own military platforms and sort of equipment. And when you have China across the West Sea and Russia up north, and that's not a very favorable environment for you. And on top of that, you have nuclear North Korea at your border, which is quite hostile against you. So that's actually the trickiest condition that you have to meet. So that makes OPCON transition, wartime OPCON transition, in some ways a very political decision. So it means politically you decide to go, or politically you decide to wait until you have a more better condition in place so that you can make the OPCON transition in a more safer way.
You know, it's funny that you offer, you know, talk about this specific requirement, because I was, you know, as I talk to Koreans and work with Koreans on different projects, you know, the Koreans will often suggest that they're very similar, that they're East Asia's version of Israel, and that they're, you know, they're very much the Israelis. But I would submit to you that you're in a worse position than the Israelis. Because you have, you know, the Israelis have easily managed, you know, Iran, for example. You know, they've defeated Jordan and Syria and Lebanon and Egypt, and they've handled their neighbors. You have far more powerful and larger neighbors than the Israelis do. So you're in a far more difficult position. And I happen to be a fan of Korean television. So I watch a good bit of Korean television, and I can't help but think, you know, I was watching one that's it's a period piece that takes place during Japan's occupation of Korea. And they want to know, they're constantly asking, about the characters and people involved. Are they Chosun or are they, you know, Japanese? So they're Chosun or Japanese. And for you, the American audience, you know, Chosun, that's Koreans. And so it's a difficult environment. And I certainly understand the Korean desire to never be in that position again, which is certainly where the rock is right now. They don't want to ever be in that position again. They don't want to be in that position in regards to the Chinese, the Japanese, or anybody else. And, you know, the U.S. has played an important role in enabling that. But it's going to be as China becomes more assertive and aggressive, it's certainly going to be a difficult position to navigate for South Korea. As can you maybe, before I bring out Bob the Genie, because we're getting to that time in the show, can you maybe give us a little bit about sort of what is the new administration? Is it going to do anything differently in regards to China? Is it going to be less likely to, you know, let's say have THAAD or THAAD radars in, you know, South Korea? Or is it still, you know, does it see, you know, North Korea is a problem and it's our biggest problem, but we always have to keep an eye on China? Or is it a different approach?
Well, it's certainly going to be a different approach. If I give you the short version of my answer, since China is not the China that the former Nomuyen administration or the Moon Jae-in administration has faced during their time. So Nomuyen administration was the progressive government back in early 2000s. Former President Moon Jae-in's time was during the fire and fury phase, but that was a time when U.S.-China competition was already getting more intense. China showing more coercive or aggressive foreign policy attitudes, obviously in South China Sea, East China Sea, along the Taiwan Strait. But now it's a more intense security environment when you think about China. There were recent news reports about China installing certain structures in the West Sea along the middle line where we share with China. It's not becoming a very hot issue yet, but it's certainly grabbing a lot of attention from experts here in South Korea. China has obviously said that they don't have any intentions with regards to these installments. They don't have any ill intentions. But we've seen things happen in South China Sea. We've seen things how they're being, you know, have those kind of fighter jets scrambling in the Senkaku Islands with Japan. So we're getting concerned. Whether there's going to be change in China policy, to some degree, I mean, when it comes to economy, the government has to think about small businesses. And these small businesses have to this huge reliance on the Chinese market and also the supply chain network. It has to go through China at some point in their supply chain networks. So unlike big firms, the government has to sort of manage relations with China to sort of soften the damage, soften the blow, economic damages, so that our economy sort of doesn't go into recession. Now, having said that, we've had a lot of attempts, back and forth dialogue with our Chinese counterparts about how to manage North Korea, how we can bring them back to the negotiation table, how we can sort of, you know, make North Korea a more normal state. But that expectation, I would say, has sort of deteriorated over the years, because every time we've sort of communicated our wish, so to speak, our sort of concern to the Chinese about North Koreans, it really did not work the way we wanted it to. So there's been frustrations, and even the Chinese have admitted that they don't really have that kind of leverage or influence on North Korea. So although this government, the new government, would try to, you know, see whether China does actually have some sort of leverage on North Korea still, they would also have more realistic expectations, that they will see limitations about Chinese leverage, influence, and given the security environment, as I said, with the installments and with certain intrusions into our West Sea area, fishing areas, and those kind of joint exercises that the PLA does with North Koreans, the Russians, in the West Sea or the EC, the Sea of Japan. The government policy would not be the same. There are a lot more to consider. I wouldn't say there's going to be, I hope that there's not going to be another THAAD sort of incident, like that kind of tension. But despite the government effort to restore Korea-China relations, it wouldn't be easy given the circumstances, I would say.
Okay. Yeah, that's always a difficult one, right? When you trade with people, and then, you know, this is sort of a new time, right? You know, historically you don't trade with your enemies, but here we are, you know, both the U.S. and China trade quite a bit. Korea trades with China. And so we'll see how that works out. Now, it is that time of the show where I like to bring out Bob the Genie. So as I rub my magic lamp, Bob the Genie pops out and he grants all guests 3 wishes. So Gibum, what is your first wish? Oh, let me say, you can't wish for wealth, health, any of that stuff. You got to keep it related to our topics. So with that in mind, what is your first wish?
Okay. My first wish is, since the government, our defense minister nominee has mentioned that this government will also adhere to the non-proliferation principles and policies. My first wish would be that this government try its best to reinforce our 3K system capabilities. The 3K meaning kill chain, KAMD, Korean Air Missile Defense, and KMPR meaning Korean Massive Punishment and Retaliation Capabilities, so that we can enhance our deterrence posture, although they will be mostly conventional systems.
Yeah. I don't think I've heard the 3Ks before, so that's a first for me. So thanks for sharing that. Okay, so that's number one. Wish number one. How about wish number two?
Wish number two. It would definitely be about becoming a more reliable and stronger partner within the Raucous Alliance, meaning that we, although some would say still that Korea is a junior partner, I'm sure that the current government and the former government even wanted South Korea to be seen as a more equal or capable partner. And I wish that this government really advances that objective. So that while South Korea becomes a more capable state, that we sort of share burdens, share roles, and become a more active partner regionally and globally.
Yeah, I mean it would be perfectly reasonable to see Korea, for the United States to remain globally sort of the big brother, but then locally on the peninsula that Korea is equal, if not superior. So I think that would be, and sort of an expectation, I would think. But, okay. So that's a good wish. That's another good wish. So we're down. We've got one and two down. So you're down to your final wish now. What's your final wish?
My final wish. This could be wild, but I do I do wish that South Korea, this government, could somehow manage to get its own version of AUKUS, if possible.
Okay.
Could be called another name, obviously, but if that's, that'd be my wish.
All right. Yeah, that would be, you know, between the United States, maybe Japan. So, you know, you have a new sort of three-way agreement. I could, you know, that's I don't know. I mean, that's a bigger ask for Bob the Genie, but we'll see what he can do about that. So, all right. Okay. So that's a good one. All right. Well, Gibom, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast. It was a great discussion. We haven't really talked with anybody yet about, you know, what's going on in Korea these days. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Adam. It was great pleasure to have this conversation with you.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you next time. So that was a good interview. You know, Gibom, I think, is one of the sort of the brighter, shining analysts in Korea that I've run across, younger guy. And it was great to talk to him. I enjoyed it very much. Hopefully you enjoyed it as well.
This has been a production of the Anwa Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.